come up on a tight wire.
I'm Daniel Chacon. Welcome to another edition of Words on a Wire. Today, my guest is author Philip Connors, who just came out with a new memoir called All the Wrong Places. And it is a beautiful book about dealing with the loss of his brother, who committed suicide at a very young age. And he kind of blamed himself a bit and kind of led him on a journey, a personal journey, and a narrative I think that you're going to like. So stick around and listen to Philip talk about this fantastic new book, All the Wrong Places. And one of the things that I started to think about as I was reading this is a quote that I encountered years ago from Robert Frost. Writers should either farm or else cheat their employers. And this kind of makes sense to me, because when you farm, you have seasons when you don't have to do anything. Like during the winter, you just hold up in the house waiting for the next season to go. And during that time, you could write a bunch of books. And then on the seasons that you need to get out there and harvest, you're under the sun, you're putting your hands in the earth. It makes sense that that would be a good job for a writer. But the cheat their employers also makes a lot of sense, because when you're a writer, you have to have some means of working for a living and writing while you're working. And sometimes that means cheating your employer. And I don't mean literally cheating. I remember when I was a community college teacher, I used to teach classes of 35 people, and we'd have to do compositions, and I would get these stacks and stacks of papers. It was a full-time job, believe me. It was a community college. They didn't care if I published. They just cared how many classes I taught. And I remember sometimes when I was having really good writing morning, I would go into class, and I still wanted to write, and I would say to the students, okay, pull out a piece of paper. We're going to write for 40 minutes. And then, of course, I would write along with them. That was my way of cheating my employer so I can write. And writers will do just about any job to be able to be a writer. And you're never going to guess what my guest, Phil Connors, does as a job. It is probably the most amazing job a writer could have, short of my job. Of course, I love my job because all I have to do is teach what I'm writing. I work in a research institution, so I teach what I'm writing. And then my other job, of course, is working here on the radio station, which is basically talking about books. But I would do anything, like most writers, to support my writing. William S. Burroughs was an exterminator. He killed bugs and rats and then went home and wrote Naked Lunch. James Joyce used to sing and play the piano, and he was doing this while he was writing Dubliners, which is one of the best collection of stories in the English language, and it was rejected 22 times. I wonder if he sang the blues during all those rejections. J.D. Salinger was an entertainment director on a Swedish luxury liner. That's an interesting job. And Raymond Carver, he worked with his father at a sawmill, and he was a janitor, and he was a delivery man. And when he became successful, he got a job at UTEP, right here at the University of Texas, El Paso. He taught creative writing. I don't know if anybody knows that, but he was here for a year. Haruki Murakami, incredible writer. He used to work at a record store, which makes sense, because a lot of his work has to do with jazz, so I bet being around all those records was exciting for him. Harper Lee, who, as we know, just came out with a new book, and we'll try to get her on the show. Norma, can we do that? I'm sure we can get her on the show. She was a reservation clerk for an airline, but then one day she received a note from her friends, and it said, and I quote, "You have 1 year off from your job to write whatever you please. Merry Christmas." And it was a big, fat check. I need friends like that. So, my friends, if you're listening, I would love to have a year off just to write. Ken Casey, as you know, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, he made money by volunteering his mind to psych experiments by the CIA. He experienced many drug hallucinations during this experiment, which explains not only One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, but his Merry Pranksters and all that other weird stuff he wrote. But Phil Connors, author of the new book, All the Wrong Places, his job, which only he has to do half a year, the other half of the year he just writes, his job is to stand on a tower overlooking the mountains of New Mexico. And I'm talking about a view of miles and miles and miles and miles of mountains. His only job is to stand up there and to look out for fires, look out for smoke. Can you imagine that kind of job for a writer? It's perfect. No wonder this book is so brilliant. And it goes to show that no matter what you do, a writer is a writer, and anything can end up in your writing. Let's talk to Philip Connors. Philip Connors was born in Iowa and grew up on a farm in southern Minnesota. He earned a BA in print journalism from the University of Montana and worked several years at the Wall Street Journal, mostly as the editor of the Leisure and Art page. In 2002, he left to New York to get that awesome job as a fire lookout in New Mexico's Gila National Forest, where he has spent every summer since. And that experience became the subject of his first book, Fire Seasons, Field Notes from a Wilderness Lookout, which won several awards. His next book, the one we're going to talk about today, is called All the Wrong Places, and it has been just released by W.W. Norton. Philip, welcome to Words on a Wire. First of all, let me say this book is amazing. It's powerful. It blew me away at times, and at times it's so calm, and at other times it's just so heartbreakingly beautiful. I remember I saw you at a reading in El Paso when the book first came out, and you had this stack of notebooks that you had written in over the years after your brother's suicide. How long would you say you have been working on this book from the first moment before you even knew it was going to be a book all the way until the last draft that you sent into your editor?
Well, from the moment that I knew I was going to write a book, we're talking more than 10 years. But those notebooks you mentioned seeing at my reading in El Paso, my little show and tell, which are meant to illustrate just how desperately I needed to talk about this event in my life, that begins the day I got the news about my brother's death. So that's the summer of 1996, 18 and a half years ago, is when I began to try to write my way through the experience of having a brother commit suicide. So it's been in the works, I suppose you could say, since the day it happened.
Well, that's how it definitely seems to me, because it is something that you had to deal with. The suicide of a brother, I imagine, must be incredibly life-changing. And, you know, especially if you think too much, and you seem like the kind of guy, based on the narrative that I'm reading, where you've spent a lot of time alone thinking.
Yeah, I suppose I was always a sensitive young man. But this event, you know, exacerbated that, I think. And you can't help but have very deep, profound emotional reaction to the fact that your only brother, in the end, chose death over life in a moment of crisis. So naturally, I've thought about him, I've thought about what he did, and of course I thought about the ways I may have failed him pretty incessantly over the years. And that was the only way through for me, was to try to confront it, to try to wrestle with it, and to try to muddle my way through to the other side. It was too big and too profound of an event to lock it away in a box and try to push it down into some dark corner of my psyche. That just did not seem like it was going to work out for me.
And there's two incidents shortly after your brother's death that really struck me as something that just wouldn't let you go. And the first one is knowing that the last time you talked to him, he called you and he wanted to talk, but you were too busy and a little impatient with him. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, this would have been about 6 months or so, maybe a little more, before he died. And he called me at home one night wanting to chat. And partly my reaction to him that night was based on the last time I had seen him, a visit during which he uttered a phrase that I took to be racist and distasteful.
Mm-hmm.
And I, at that time, I thought, you know, when the kid grows up, then we'll reconnect. And I just sort of wrote him off, I suppose you could say, for a while, thinking he would mature, he would get beyond that at some point. And so when he called me that last time, I think I was still in that mindset of, you know, I don't know if I can deal with him right now. And yeah, I put him off, and I never spoke to him again. And of course, that fact haunts me even to this day. I no longer think that I, you know, am culpable for what he did, but I do feel like I missed an opportunity to connect with him. And that's a terrible thing to think, because I no longer have a chance to connect with him. He's gone.
Right, but that's an important distinction, because at first one couldn't help thinking, if I had just talked to him, maybe things would be different. But then there's a certain point in the narrative, you know, after years and years of thinking about it and writing about it and feeling this way and that, where you finally realize, well, his death, his suicide isn't about me. And you had to let that part go.
Right. I think that's one of the terrible things about a suicide of someone close to you, is it almost can't help but arouse this terrible narcissism.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. Absolutely.
Yeah, right, where you think you could have had the power to prevent this. In fact, it's so hard to think that you couldn't have had the power to prevent it, that you can't allow yourself to think that.
Yeah. I mean,
because you love the person, and you want to believe that you were enough of a sustaining connection that if you had reached out in the right moment, you could have made a difference. And so it's really hard to let that go.
Yeah. You know, I've encountered people who have known victims of suicide, and even those who aren't brothers. You and your brother were very close when you were kids. I mean, you grew up on a farm. You said you never remember a boring moment in your childhood. You did so many fun and creative things. You were very close to them. But I find that even people who aren't close to suicide victims, if they're, you know, even distant friends that haven't talked in a while, the first emotional reaction is to make it about you, to make it about, if you know, what could I have done? But like you said, it's really not a question of why your brother committed suicide, but it was more like, you know, why was his life, you know, in such a shambles that he felt that he needed to do it, which really makes the question about him and not about you.
Right. Yeah. I mean, part of the guilt that arises is it just feels like a renunciation on the part of that person of all the connections that sustained them in life. And so, in a way, it almost feels like a judgment rendered by that person.
Uh-huh.
That life wasn't worth living anymore, and it's almost, you can't help but feel like, gosh, does that say something about my inability to provide this person I loved or knew with something essential? And then, you know, eventually, if you work your way through that, you realize in that moment, that person, when they made that choice, had lost all sense of other people entirely. If you still had other people that you cared about in your mind at that moment, you probably couldn't go through with that, because you would intuit what that would leave all the people you care about with.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that in that moment, the person is just lost in their own pain, and it doesn't really have anything to do with you, with the person you,
right,
they loved.
The other thing that really struck me, a moment after his death, you were with family, and whenever we're at funerals, people say this and they say that, and but for some reason, something your uncle said really struck you and stayed with you. And he said something along the lines of, you know, if I had to guess which of the brothers would have committed suicide, I would have guessed it would have been Philip.
Right. Yeah, I probably should have made this ever so slightly clearer in the book, but he was actually relaying something that someone else had said.
Oh, okay. Uh-huh.
In the family, part of the extended family. And as you point out, you know, a funeral is sort of a pressure cooker moment. Everybody's under enormous emotional strain. People say strange things.
Mm-hmm.
But with my uncle, he and I had always practiced a pretty healthy candor and honesty and openness with each other. And so I didn't necessarily blame him for relaying this piece of information to me. I did find it extraordinary, and it was sort of a double-edged sword, because a part of me thought, gosh, maybe everybody's grief would have been a little less intense if I had been the one that we were gathered here for today. That's a dark road one doesn't really want to go too far down. And so I, in the end, I flipped it on its head and tried to look at it from a different angle, which was that, you know, I'm still here. The rest of my life is a sort of gift. And in a way, it almost liberated me to think, well, I'm still here. I can make of myself whatever I want to be, because perhaps I'm playing with house money by being here still.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I don't know, I felt I needed to transform that comment into something positive, and that's how I did it.
I'm talking to Philip Connors, author of All the Wrong Places, a new memoir. And I don't want to give our listeners the wrong idea. It really is incredibly sad, but there's also some wonderfully humorous moments in here. And the narrative, it escalates, it culminates, and it reads in many ways like a novel. It's a page-turner, basically incredibly well-written. There's a certain point where the language, I love this shift of language. You're kind of trying to, you know, to deal with it the way you feel, and you have to confront yourself with the facts. And so when you do, you finally on page 24, I think it's, you just list, you say, here are the known facts. He'd spent the afternoon with friends drinking. He'd spoke to Wendy in the evening by phone. He hadn't shown up for work the next morning. He died alone in his apartment. He'd done that deed with a gun. All these subject verb sentences, list, 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 which completely seems to take the emotion out of it and to reveal it in maybe the way, only way you were capable of at that time. I'm curious about your writing this passage. Did this come immediately, or was it something that you had to keep working on over and over to get the language just precisely right?
Yeah, in fact, that was probably one of the last pieces of the book that came together for me, because I tried again and again to evoke that moment. It's such a dramatic moment. It's the moment that changed my life. It's the moment that ended my brother's life. And so how to describe that? And it, to me, it just seemed, having tried so many different ways to do so, that less was more. I didn't need to emphasize the emotional impact of that moment on me and those close to my brother. I didn't need to ramp up the language to try to freight that moment with added meaning. The meaning is clear, I think. I think the discerning reader will feel the impact of that just by those few sentences that you just quoted. That was my hope, anyway.
No, it's a brilliant passage. It expresses it far better than had the sentences gone on and on, and, you know, for a whole page with, you know, commas and commas and commas. It really captures, you know, arriving at some point where you have to admit to yourself this is what went on. So I think it's fantastic. The story is compelling in itself, not only about your brother's suicide, which really is, you know, holds the thing together, but also your experience as a journalist. How one of your first jobs was with the Wall Street Journal, basically taking faxes to reporters, and then moving to a neighborhood, and I think it was Brooklyn, wasn't it?
Yeah.
That was pretty much 97% black. I think there's, you know, out of 4,000 people, there are 13 white people in it. And all that experience was just, you know, really nice and fascinating. But I want to ask you a little bit about that neighborhood. Being other in that place seems to me that it would push you further into this interior life, this living with your thoughts and contemplating things over and over. Do you find that experience became fundamental not only to your ultimate decision to leave the Washington Post, but even to how you dealt with your brother's death?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think you hit on one of the essential threads of the book, and that's that I did feel so alone and so other in my experience of being a suicide survivor, a thing we have such a difficult time talking about, and I really couldn't find anybody to talk about it with, that I found ways in my day-to-day life to perpetuate that sense of otherness and outsiderness and isolation. And so, gosh, what could be more perfect for a white boy from a pig farm in Minnesota to gravitate to this neighborhood in Bedford-Stuyvesant, Brooklyn, where every single moment I was there, I was hyper-conscious of myself as an outsider. It was a strange thing. In a way, I think it was almost useful, in fact, to be conscious of my skin color, because as a white American, you often aren't. You feel, at least in the places I grew up, to be part of the dominant majority. And so to have that experience, in a way, was useful. But it's also an experience I sought out again and again, ways to bring the discomfort of my inner life into alignment with my exterior life by putting myself in, as the title of the book says, all the wrong places.
Right. There's even another parallel to that isolation and how it perhaps feeds you creatively and feeds you intellectually, emotionally, and that is you end up on a tower in New Mexico by yourself, isolated from the rest of the world. And apparently you told me, listening to Words on a Wire occasionally, but you're up on that tower looking out for firefighters. And that experience, can you tell us a little bit about that? Because I find that incredibly fascinating, to go from living in New York City, working for the Wall Street Journal, and quite frankly, your career seemed to be going pretty well with that McDonald's story you wrote. And if we have time, we'll talk a little bit about that, because I think that's hilarious that was your break into the business. But tell us about that, standing on a tower. At least I picture you standing with binoculars, looking off onto the landscape for fires.
Yeah, can you believe it? I'm in the 21st century and I get paid to sit and look at mountains all day.
That's awesome.
The craziest job you can imagine.
But and not related to journalism, even.
Pretty far from the hustle and bustle of the Wall Street Journal newsroom, yeah, for sure. You know, in a way, the book ends with me finally finding the right place. And it all happened because I had a friend who had this job as a fire lookout in New Mexico. And I went down to visit her. And something extraordinary happened the first time that I climbed that fire tower and popped through the trap door into the tower. I felt a strange sense of deja vu. And what it was, I later realized, was it called back for me a memory of being in a hot air balloon with my brother the last time I saw him alive.
Absolutely, which opens the book.
Right, so that's where the book opens, with this incredible balloon flight I took with him in Albuquerque in 1995. And 7 years later, I find myself at this fire tower and just feeling a sense of calm and peace and a connection to something meaningful. I couldn't quite put my finger on it at first, but that's what it was. It called back for me that sense of being in a high place with a tremendous sweeping view. And the view was actually similar in ways, because in the distance was the Rio Grande, just as it had been in that hot air balloon ride over Albuquerque. And I was looking at the Caballo Mountains, which called back for me a sense of looking across to the east at the Sandias. And so, in a way, that solitude and that peace in that place is a way for me to cultivate a connection to what was best in my brother. And so that's why, part of why, it feels like the right place for me.
Yeah, and all the metaphorical possibilities aside, because one can really look at that image that at the end of the book and compare it to the first image and can make such connections to as in reconciling the story of your brother's death, you kind of become your brother in a sense at the end, because frankly, your brother would have loved a job like that. I mean, he would have loved it to do that and then on the weekends go up on his balloons. But putting all those, you know, metaphorical possibilities aside, just being up there as a writer, because quite frankly, this book, you know, it's got so much literary depth. It's not a journalistically thin, you know, I mean, you have metaphorical possibilities all over the place. And the language at times is poetry. Like, for example, there's one point where you're talking about how slow the days go by. And you say, I swim through time like motor oil. But being on that tower, do you get to write during that time? Or, I mean, what is your day like?
Yeah, that's part of the attraction of being there for me. It's essentially a paid writing retreat every summer. I can multitask by simply standing in front of my typewriter, which I have on a little stand.
Like Hemingway.
Yeah, I'm off the grid, so I got to rock it old school with the Olivetti Latera 32. But, you know, as long as I stay awake and look out the window every 10 to 15 minutes, I'm doing my job,
Wow. Actually.
And so I have the time there to write and to read and to immerse myself deeply in the habits of creativity. And I don't think without that, I could have written a book like this.
Right.
I really needed that amount of time and that solitude to see my way through this very confusing story. And I'm so grateful that this job still exists and that I found my way to it. And yeah, I'll be going back for my 14th season,
Jeez,
Fire Tower, in April of this year.
I just want to say to the readers to pick up this book, All the Wrong Places, Philip Connor's memoir about suicide and about self-discovery and about so many other things. And in the course of the investigation, when you decide to just do something about it and you want to really kind of figure out, a secret is revealed. I don't want to tell the listeners what that secret is, but that's just another example of how the further you get into this novel, the more layers are uncovered, and it's a fantastic read. Philip, thank you for joining us on Words on a Wire.
Daniel, thank you. As you mentioned, I've been a fan of your show for years, and I'm a devoted listener to KTEP, so it's a pleasure to have been with you today.
I'd like to thank Philip Connors for joining me on Words on a Wire, and make sure you pick up that memoir. It is a fascinating read. It is compelling, and it moves along the pages like, not like you're swimming through motor oil, but like you're swimming through cool water. And from now on, every time I do a show, I'm going to think about him up in that tower, listening to us. Philip, if you're listening right now, what a job you got. I'm Daniel Chacon. Don't forget, the next book you read may save your life.
I'm up on a tight wire. One side's ice and one is fire. It's a circus game with you and me. I'm up on a tight rope. One side's hate and one is hope.